Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Game one of the Stanley Cup Final was epic. It was one for the ages. You had 10 goals. You had 4 lead changes. You had a carrot top appearance. You set the bar that high right out of the gate. It's going to be nearly impossible to reach it for the rest of the series. And yet, the Caps and the Golden Knights did it again. Now, Game 2 might not have had that same volume of goals as Game 1, but it had pure action. Lots of action. There was a classic pregame duel between the Golden Knight and somebody representing the Capitals before the game. You had a mini brawl on the ice after the final horn, and in between, lots and lots of juice. Less than 8 minutes in, James Neal got loose. Vegas got nice.
Flips it to the neutral zone, up to the line. It comes to Neal, left side, he shoots, he scores! Wait a minute. The linesman looked like he might have been signaling offside. We'll wait and see, but it looks like the Knights have scored. James Neal on the left wing, and Vegas strikes first in game one.
Thanks to Knights Radio. I mean, damn, he made that look easy. And when the Golden Knights get rolling, and that joint gets rocking, it looked like it was going to be a long night for the Caps once again. But if you thought these Caps were going to go into the tank, you clearly have not been paying attention. They have trailed in every series so far, so they were not about to trip. Because these Caps are not the Caps that you think you know. They don't take a knee when they get punched in the face. They don't grip at the first sign of adversity. They rise up, and they did it again, even after they lost Evgeny Kuznetsov for the game in the first period. First, there was the goal from Lars Eller. It tied the game up at 1 at 7:27 in the first period. Then, they kept the foot down when they got a goal from the legend himself.
A puck to Backstrom, into the right dot. Low now to Weller. Gives it back, top circle. Carlson, quickly back to Nate Backstrom. Low in front, Ovechkin scores! Ovechkin on the feed on a backdoor! Short side against Fleury! The big man gives Washington the lead!
Caps Radio, the big man. 607 regular season goals, but the guy's taken plenty of heat over the years for failing to show up and show out for the Caps in the postseason. He's had that rap. We all know that rap. He's killed that rap this year. 13 goals, 11 assists, and a truckload of enormous hits. This cat has set the tone for the Caps throughout the playoffs. So it should come as no surprise that he scored a big goal last night. Now, what might be surprising was Brooks Orpik burying one.
As Vegas hit collapse, now the Caps bringing it across and a chance in the right circle. He scores! The shot from the top of the right circle from Brett Connolly. And with 10:19 to go, it's 3-1 Washington.
First goal in 220 games could not come at a better time. And when he gets one in that situation on a big stage, you start to think maybe it is the Caps night. Maybe it's the Caps season. But just as you knew that the Caps were not going to fold, there was no way Vegas was going to give in either. And they got one back at 17:47 in the second period. So 3-2 heading into the third. Vegas gets a 5-on-3 for more than a minute in the third, but they couldn't capitalize. But with 2 minutes left, they pulled the goalie. They were mounting pressure. You knew it was only a matter of time before the dam would break. And it did. Alex Tuck had a wide open look. He had a wide open net. Alvey, roll it.
2 minutes to go. And a puck dumped in. Holtby watching a bad bounce out of the corner. And a shot and a save made by Braden Holtby. Oh, my! As Alex Tuck was robbed on a puck that came bouncing out of the corner. And Washington by a whisker. Still on top with 1:59 to go. My goodness, Braden Holtby.
It's so tired, but I'll say it anyway. Wait, what? Absolutely amazing. Run that back again. I still can't believe what I saw. How the hell did Holtby get all the way over there in time? How the hell did that not go in?
2 minutes to go, and a puck dumped in. Holtby watching a bad bounce out of the corner, and a shot and a save made by Braden Holtby. Oh, my! As Alex Tuck was robbed.
If Washington wins the cup, that right there is going to be the reason. Because that puck was all but buried in the very back of the net until Holtby somehow got that lumber in the way and went legend. I'm not sure who was more surprised, Alex Tuck or Doc Emrick. Called a tie for first. I'm not sure who had a better reaction on that play, Braden Holtby or Doc Emrick. Call that a tie for first. Washington's Lars Eller, quote, it shouldn't be possible. Washington's Jay Beagle, maybe the save of a lifetime. It's unreal. Washington's Braden Holtby, well, luckily it hit me. In other words, about the only guy who was not impressed was Braden Holtby. But the rest of the world was, and for very good reason. Because of him, that game wasn't tied. And the series is tied, 1-1, heading back to Washington. And good luck trying to top the first two games in Vegas for drama, excitement, and hype. An incredible start to the final. And the best thing about Washington winning last night is we are now guaranteed at least three more games of that. I'll say it again. The NHL postseason is the best postseason. And the Stanley Cup final is going to be way more lit than the NBA finals. And that generally is the case. And if you would just do what I tell you to do every single year right about this time and actually watch the Stanley Cup playoffs, you would know that already. That's why I say this every single year. The Stanley Cup playoffs, the NHL postseason, is better than any postseason. But if you're not watching hockey and you don't like it, you'll never know that. But every single year when I say that, I always get calls and tweets from people saying, yeah, Rome, I really didn't buy it. I really couldn't wait to call you out on it. But you're right. It is different. It is better. Brian Scalabrine is my guest. Brian, good to have you back. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jim. How are you doing?
Scal, I'm great. It's great to talk to you. And I was thinking about you and your career. Hard to imagine, but we are now 10 years out from your NBA title back in 2008. So let me start right there. Like, what kind of emotions and feelings did you have the morning of the start of those NBA finals?
You know what? It was my third at the time because I went twice with the Nets. And it gets more serious along as you go. And that team was so unique. And so I wasn't really nervous. I thought I was more nervous at the start of the playoffs in the Atlanta series than I was at the NBA Finals, just because, you know, I think we were all ready. We were all prepared. We kind of like had our speed bumps along the way. But I think myself, as well as the rest of the squad, was really confident going into that series.
All right, so when you mentioned that team was unique, it was in so many different ways. Like, when you play in the NBA, you're always going to be surrounded by competitive guys all the time. I mean, it's just a function of the league, right? But have you ever been surrounded by as many guys who had the kind of competitiveness that you all had on that 08 Celtics team?
Not even close. And it was, you know, like, I think you can make that argument when you're on the floor. You know, this like, hey, this team's competitive. These guys want to win. But it was nonstop everywhere you went. Locker room, weight room, gambling about, you know, how many pull-ups a guy can do. Kendrick Perkins, 50 push-ups in the snow. Can he do it in less than 2 minutes? You know, $5,000 on the line. It was like, can you make a free throw without hitting the rim? If you do, $1,000. You know, it was like that type of environment. And you just had to get used to it. And every day you had to bring your A game. And I think a lot of that, just the intensity of the whole entire team, and everyone one-upping each other, like Paul Pierce one-upping Garnett, Garnett one-upping Ray, and it's just going into a cycle, pushed everyone to be that elite at the end.
Brian Scalabrine joining us. You know, I wonder, since you've had success on every single level of basketball, when it's all said and done, is there anything, though, that compares to the feeling of being an NBA champion, a world champion? How do you describe that?
Well, I love the moment when I finally won one in 08, but I wish we would have won another one because I would have celebrated so much better. Like, I didn't even know what to expect. It was almost like a relief, and I didn't know what to do. But I think if we were really close in 2010 in Game 7 in L.A., I think the only thing that could top one would be to get two. Now, I don't know what it's like after 2 to 3, 3 to 4, all that. But I know that, like, 2010 haunts us as a group, me personally, and drives me more. Even now, it's like I'm not even playing anymore. Just for the simple opportunities and the fine line between success and failure than winning in 2008.
God, there's so much in that that's so interesting to me. Hey, Brian, why is it that it's like this in every every sport, every walk of life, you always seem to think about the one that got away as opposed to the one you cashed in. Why do you think that is? I mean, you probably do think more about 2010 than 2008, right? Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's just, you know, when you start looking at athletes in general, I always think, and I'm a little bit different to this, and everyone talks about, you know, when you get knocked down, like, pull yourself back up, right? That's like the slogan for everybody. But I identify athletes as actually the opposite. The ones that impress me the most are the ones that succeed and, like, continue to push the next year. I don't know how those guys continue. I think that's more mind-boggling as when you have success and you're getting pulled a million different directions, you know, this opportunity, that opportunity, these people want to pay you for an appeal, like all that kind of stuff, and you get complacent. How do the greats continue to push over and over again? I think that's what separates, like, the greats from a good or a good to an average is the ones that handle success more than the ones that, like, when they're back against the wall. Like, all athletes have had their back against the wall at some point. Not all athletes have had success on a major level.
Clones, cops are stepping up enforcement on motorists who are not wearing their seatbelts. If you've thought to yourself, I'm not going very far, or I'm in a rush, or seatbelts are just too uncomfortable, then know this, you're putting yourself at the risk of injury or death. There is never a good excuse not to buckle up, because it's always dangerous to not wear your seatbelt when you get behind the wheel of a car. Click it or ticket is not about citations. It's about saving lives. When you're not wearing your seatbelt, you're risking serious injury or death. It's a fact. Cops are writing tickets, so don't take the risk. Don't play the odds. Again, let me say it so it sticks. Click it or ticket. We're talking to Brian Scalabrine, which brings us to the next obvious point, right? I mean, I've talked to every analyst who's come on this show about LeBron James. And how do you explain what this guy's doing? And to your very point, this guy, I mean, sure, he's had lots of losses in the finals, but this guy gets it done every single year on a personal level. So how do you explain what he's still doing in his 15th season? And with all due respect to the guys that he's running with right now, I think that's what you're talking about, right? He continues to have these amazing habits and just keep grinding out.
Yeah, I think the commitment to his body is like second to none over anybody. And I think there'll be a shift in it. And it started to happen, I would say, about 10 years ago with sports science and stuff like that. I think LeBron just took it to a whole new level. And I think he continued to push the extremes of what he could do with his body. And, you know, like, for instance, like, guys who have – you don't see LeBron, like, when you follow him or whatever, you don't see him in the gym with his workout coach or anything like that. But you do see him getting body work, and he's committed to that. So I think maybe there's a shift of, like, as long as he feels like, my body is fresh and I'm able to push, then I'll be able to figure out the skill stuff later. Like, I'll figure out the jump shot. My jump shot will improve as the season. But for me, it's about health. I got to be healthy. I got to be explosive. And you just talk to his sponsors and Nike and what they're willing to do and, you know, his full commitment to trying different things out, his body work guy. I guess the number comes in at $2 million a year he invests back into his body to get what we're seeing out of it. I'm not sure most NBA players are doing that. Some guys don't even have the, you know, the resources to do that. But, you know, LeBron, and I think he'll probably take it to a new level as he continues to age. But the guy is unbelievable when you think about him playing 82. He's up. He could play this year if they went to seven games. He could have the all-time record, I think, for most games played in the season, which is tremendous.
You know, and he gets it, doesn't he, Brian, in terms of investing in his body, man, that's his moneymaker. Body as temple. He understands that. Now, you've made the point that if you're guarding LeBron, you have to assume the attitude of, I'm playing for my life. What do you mean by that, and how does that attitude impact the way you go about trying to guard him?
Well, you know, you can break down all the synergy numbers and what he does and what he's more effective. And as a coaching staff and group, you have an idea of what you want. Like, you know, you can't fit beat to his right hand because he'll get all the way to the basket. But on the left, you know, there will be more help. So let's shade him that way. But at the end of the day, I think late in the game, that's where it becomes like life or death, because he's got a great amount of shooting around him. And when you're on him, you know that, like, the shot is, used to be he couldn't do that, but now he can. So, you know, like, you're at his mercy. And then the only thing you can really do is bring two over, which really compromises the rest. So because of his ability to pass, what can you really do as far as one-on-one coverage? So it's just at that point, your back is really against the wall.
Right. So in terms of Golden State, when you look at the Warriors and you see how careless, I mean, almost bored that they are for extended periods of time, and then they can just lock in and blow teams out in the third quarter. When you see that, what do you think?
Well, I know they're supremely talented. Yeah, no question about it. But I think that's a little bit playing with fire against a team like Cleveland. Like, I remember last year in the finals, besides game four, it looked like they were relentless on beating the Cavs and what happened last year or the year before. Now, are they driven the same way? They got at times you're scratching your head, and maybe Houston sort of created a formula for beating the Warriors. And you know, Iguodala being out is not going to help them at all because they need multiple bodies to throw at LeBron. I mean, they do have guys that can throw at him, but I don't know why they let go of the rope so often. Maybe because they know that the runs could be a 12-2 run in 2 minutes, and they know they can make up for that. But it is their only flaw as a team that's, like, you know, questionably one of the greatest teams to ever play, is how careless they are at times on the floor. And I was younger back in the day, but I don't remember Shaq and Kobe's Lakers or the Jordan Bulls ever being like that. But, you know, maybe if I watch now, it'd be different.
You know, I wonder then, if you're Steve Kerr, and Steve Kerr played for those Bulls teams, if you're Kerr, how concerned are you about the fact that they have gotten into a habit where they do just enough to win, but not that much more than that? It's not like they play 48 minutes every single night, or really any night at this point. Is there anything Kerr can do to shake them out of that?
Oh, man, Jim, that's a good question. I think maybe you should ask Steve Kerr that. I don't think he has an answer. If he had an answer, wouldn't they have played better in the Houston series?
Sure.
Because then how many times did the camera pan on Kerr and he looked super frustrated? A guy who's like, Joe Cool, no tie. I'm in Golden State. It's the weather's great. I'm in the Bay Area and all this other stuff. But he looked very nervous during that entire series every time they panned him. Maybe that's just great camera work on the guy's part. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I think as a coach, that's got to be the most frustrating, no matter what level you're playing at, right? People not taking the game seriously. I just think, like, in high school, I think coaches could see that. AAU, for whatever level. But you're talking about one of the greatest teams ever, and to have the ability to be where they're at right now, yet have the lapses that they do, it just reminds, or at least for me, it reminds me of, like, how superior their talent is to the rest of the league.
See, I think they know that, right? And that's why they do what they do, because they know it's going to be fine. They know they can drop that 12-2, 18-4 run on you at any given time. They know they've got that much more talent. I think, why does anybody do anything? Because they can, and they do. Brian, let me ask you about the Celtics. When you look back on the season the Celtics had, and everything they went through with the injuries to Gordon Hayward, Kyrie Irving, they go all the way to Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals. They nearly win it. As you look back on the season, how would you sum it up?
I think we learned a lot as from, like, an NBA analyst standpoint, what young players are capable of doing. I would have never, ever in a million years, I probably did go on record at one point and talked about it will never happen again what Magic Johnson did when he was a rookie for the Lakers, like what Larry Bird did when he was a rookie. Like, this environment doesn't exist because, you know, guys are just like, you know, Jason Tatum, 2 years removed from high school. How can you be in the NBA and have an impact like that? Even LeBron, and LeBron's an all-time great. How his impact his rookie year was like a fraction of what, like, a guy like Tatum is able to do. And, you know, so I just feel like, how is this possible? Maybe it's because the game is changing right before our eyes, and it's more team basketball versus individual basketball, and maybe guys who have played high school, AAU, college, and in the NBA, the difference is not as much as it used to be. Remember, like, college was one style, NBA was another style. Man, like, these are all being blended in together nowadays, depending on your coach and your personnel. So maybe that's all the reason, but I was, like, completely shocked this year by what Mitchell did, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, Ben Simmons. I am, like floored by how good these guys are at a young age. And it's not just athleticism. It's being able to play through contact, which we used to think it took like 3 or 4 years for you to be able to play through contact. Guys are coming fresh out and able to do it. And I don't know, man. I'm going to be really hesitant to say, like, young players don't make an impact from here on out.
Oh, I think it's such a good point. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. And Tatum, I mean, Brian, 2 years removed from high school, and not only to play the way he did and physically to deal with that contact, but, man, the guy's composure and his ability to hang in the moment on the big stage blows me away. I got about a minute. I mean, is there any reason to think that he won't be a superstar? And then how does he fit in when the other big two come back next year?
So if you're watching the NBA Finals or NBA playoffs, you're noticing like the big men are becoming dinosaurs, man. They're like not even playing at times. So basically the Celtics right now have 8 good wing players, wing skill players moving forward. So I could totally see an 8-man rotation or even going 9 or 10 with a big playing periodically. But at the end of the day, skilled players that can shoot, defend, and score is what you want. Celtics got a load of them.
Experience Control GX from Just for Men. The first shampoo with a brain. So what makes it so smart? It reduces gray the same way it grows in gradually. The more you shampoo with Control GX, the less gray you have. Just use it until you like what you see. Now, how smart is that? Smart enough to be voted Men's Hair Care Product of the Year. No brushes, no messy towels, no hair dye, just shampoo. Now, how easy is that? Gradually reduce gray with the first shampoo with a brain. Find Control GX in the shave aisle. That's Control GX. All right, so let's talk Andrew Luck for a minute. If you're on hold, stay there. I've got time for your phone calls. They're coming up. Andrew Luck is back in the news, but not for throwing a football. He still has not done that. Not for gearing up for OTAs. He still has not done that. He's in the news because this dude is looking absolutely shredded. When he was spotted at the Indy 500 over the weekend, riding his Schwinn to the Brickyard, people could not believe how yoked this guy was. Have you seen the photo? If not, we're going to put it up right now on CBS Sports Network. Luck in a bike helmet that looks like the bucket that Gretzky used to wear back in the day. And he's rocking a muscle shirt with two absolutely enormous arm cannons holstered to his shoulders. This is a dude who isn't throwing a football, but he's clearly throwing iron around 7 days a week. This guy's massive. Massive. Absolutely yoked. Again, we're talking about a guy who has not thrown a football when it matters in over 500 days. Yet it's pretty clear he has not skipped byes or tries in months. If a picture is worth 1,000 words, this picture is just screaming, "Do you even lift, bro?" 200 straight times. Hey, look, whatever the hell this guy's going or doing, whatever the hell is going on with this guy is still one of the great mysteries of the NFL. I mean, we're talking about a guy who did fly to Europe for treatment, who at this time last year, he looked like a hipster in skinny jeans, drinking organic, conflict-free coffee. Now the guy looks like the Incredible Hulk. And if you're a Colts fan, you've got to be jacked up enough to throw a couple of wheels on the bench press and get a lift in on your own. Remember, it is early April. Luck was just giving us the Joel Embiid trust the process mantra.
Trust the process?
The only problem was nobody had any clue what the process was for this guy. His owner didn't. He was telling anybody who would listen that Luck would be ready for last season. And then when that didn't happen, he made it seem like it was just some issue between Andy's ears and not in the ligaments that are getting stretched to the max, just making sure that those tree trunks don't dent his torso. So it's been a minute since we've seen the guy on the field. Granted. But it's worth remembering. When he's right, he is a top-shelf franchise quarterback. When he's right, he's worth the hell of jack that they're paying him. $87 million guaranteed. And with Frank Reich bringing that Philadelphia system to Indy, Chris Ballard drafting him some protection, after some dark days, this dude looks ready, at least for suns out, guns out. You've got to see the pic. I am efforting the pic for you on TV. If not, just go to your phone. Go to your laptop. Check it out. This guy rolled up to the Indy 500 looking like the Brickyard himself. And if that beach bod is any indication, dude is going to step on the field whenever he does and throw the first football he puts his hands on out of the damn stadium. Again, I don't know if and when they'll let this guy back in the stadium. I just know that he could put it on a bar and put it up 25 times without breaking a sweat. I'm not even saying that being shredded and yoked is any guarantee that he'll get back to where he was or close to it. I'm saying this guy looks amazing. And I know what he's been doing in his spare time. Have you seen the pics? Andy is shredded. My guest is Jeff Passan. Jeff, good morning. What's up? How are you?
Vance Mack, how are you, my friend?
Good, good, bud. How about you? How are things?
Life is wonderful. Thank you for asking.
Good. Lots to cover. And I want to start with Carlos Gomez because he had some comments regarding the league's approach to drug testing. He broke it down to you on your podcast earlier this month. In a nutshell, how does he feel about the league's drug testing program?
He thinks that it's targeting old players and Dominican players, essentially. And look, Major League Baseball, when I bring this to them, says, of course it's random. We're not even running it. It's done between Major League Baseball and the Players Association with an independent crew that's doing it. We couldn't possibly have a hand in this. But look, Brian Colangelo couldn't possibly have had a hand in his own demise with 5 burner accounts either, right? I mean, there are, like, weirder conspiracies out there than Major League Baseball like to test guys who are older, who are likelier to use, or who are Dominican, who have been caught more in the past. So I think Carlos Gomez's perspective here comes from some well-earned cynicism. You know, he's been around baseball. He's seen that Major League Baseball as a sport has mistreated, frankly, Dominican players for decades upon decades, whether it was paying them scant bonus amounts. I mean, you know, Sammy Sosa signing for $2,000, Miguel Tejada signing for $3,000, you know, guys who were superstars getting pennies on the dollar because they came from poor countries and didn't know any better and didn't have the people to negotiate it for them, to these days when I think Dominican players simply don't feel like they're marketed properly or enough, or they have a large enough voice at the bargaining table. So this is something that's been brewing for a long time. And while I'm not positive by any means that Dominican players or older players are being tested more, I can understand why Carlos Gomez might feel that way.
Jeff Passan, MLB columnist for Yahoo Sports. Jeff, you mentioned Brian Colangelo. You know, I hit on this yesterday, and I'm kind of staying away from it today because fact is, at first, allegedly, it's Colangelo who's responsible for the 5 burner accounts. Then, allegedly, it's his father. Now, allegedly, it's his wife. So, until I know more, I'm just going to kind of stay away from it. But you brought it up. What is your reaction to that entire story?
It's the greatest thing I've ever heard. Like, honestly, I was reading that, and
isn't it what makes the NBA great?
It really is. Dan Wetzel wrote a great column on it, just saying that this is what the NBA is all about. And here's the thing. Almost every general manager that I know has a burner account, but he's not stupid enough to actually go tweet from it. And I almost feel like whether this was Brian Colangelo or whether this was somebody who was close to him, it's like an Icarus type thing. You know, when you get that close to the sun, you are going to combust, but you want to keep getting closer and closer. So you send that first tweet out, and nobody understands that it's you, and you don't get in trouble for it. And it's like a dopamine hit. And then you want more, so you send another out. And then you get a little riskier and riskier. And all of a sudden, you've been doing this, and it becomes part of your everyday life. It becomes part of who you are. And you almost lose a grasp on what reality is and what proper behavior is in this situation. And, you know, my friend Adrian Wojnarowski, he tweeted that GMs keep asking him, what is the calculus here? Like, why would he do this? Why would he risk something for something so stupid and so trivial? But we're flawed people, man. We are human beings, and even though we want to act in our best interest at all times, emotion can get in the way. And when you are being just lambasted and compared to your predecessors, who you think you're better than, and others are out there saying otherwise, it's tough to ignore that. I mean, you see it every day on Twitter. I see it every day on Twitter. People who are out there in jobs that are public get crushed. That's just part of the gig, though. And whether it was Brian Colangelo or someone in his family, you need to know that being deaf to things like that is one of the most important parts of the job these days, because if you're not, it's going to come back and bite you.
Okay, you put that so well. That's exactly what that is. I mean, you have to school everybody in the family up. Look, every public figure, Jeff, knows this. We all understand this. Early on, as I started to do this and everybody was coming at me with lots of hate, I would say to my wife and I would say to my family and say to my friends, listen, stop reading that stuff. If it bothers you that much, do not read it, because I don't want you to keep running it back to me, because it's always going to be there. So you need to know this going in. But wouldn't he or everybody else know that going in? Maybe, maybe not, I guess.
And look, you read it. I don't mind reading it. I don't mind hearing it, because I almost feel like it's my responsibility to know what people are thinking and saying, because sometimes they're going to be right. And I'm not arrogant enough to believe that I am the best at what I do, or that everything I say or think is correct. And I want to get better, and I want to be smarter. And I think there's a little humility involved in that. And sometimes when you're in a job like running a team, and someone like Sam Hinkie has come in before you and done something so unorthodox and so different and eventually so productive, you almost feel like you're in a no-win situation, that you can't do better than that, so you get defensive about it. But Brian Colangelo is a two-time NBA Executive of the Year. If defensiveness is one of those traits that is going to define you, then there's something far deeper there that I think people probably don't realize or never did about him that's coming out and finally manifesting itself now publicly.
My man Jeff Passan showing some amazing range. I did not think that we would cover that topic today, so let me keep moving, and I appreciate it. Now, as long as we're talking about testing, let's go back to that for a minute. In Major League Baseball, the league did commission a study to examine the baseballs, and the result of that study was the balls in 2016 and 2017 had lower drag coefficients than in previous years. What's your reaction to that study?
It's not surprising that the balls are different, because I never bought the idea that players changing the lift on their swing and having a higher launch angle would be that big of a differentiator with home runs. I mean, home runs were at the highest rate they've ever been last year. It was absurd how the ball was flying, and it still is to an extent. But to have that leap from even just a couple of years ago, when home runs were down so low, Major League Baseball was asking itself, you know, are we developing power hitters anymore? I think the thing to take out of this is that Major League Baseball was not actively juicing the balls. I think the likeliest explanation, and this is almost weird in a sense, is that Major League Baseball, the people who make the balls down in Costa Rica have gotten so good at making the balls and gotten so efficient that the center of the ball it's being wound slightly differently. And if the center of the ball is even the slightest bit off, think about what happens when you have like one of those ball, if you have like a baseball that's a tiny bit off center, it almost wobbles, right? So that wobble is going to increase the drag on the ball. If you have the center of the ball exactly in the middle, the wobble's not going to be quite as much, and you're likelier to have a ball with less drag then, and it's going to fly farther. So it's almost like baseball potentially has been a victim of its own manufacturing process, and that the people are doing such a good job of making baseball these days that they're flying farther. Now, how do you combat that? That's a difficult thing to say. Is this something that you just get used to? I think that probably is going to be the solution.
Clones, you will deal with this guy in the smack off on July 20th. Jeff Passan, my guest. Jeff, I got to ask you about Mike Trout before you go. 59 hits this year, 34 are for extra bases. He's got a game on Saturday in New York where he went 5-for-5 with 3 doubles and a home run. He's top 3 in the American League in home runs, runs, walks, stolen bases, slugging percentage, and OPS. I mean, and on top of all that, nobody says anything because we expect all this from this guy.
I know.
He's 26. If he keeps up at this rate, that what we're seeing right now from him, what are we going to think when we look back on his career?
Mike Trout doesn't have 10 years in the big leagues yet, so he's not technically a Hall of Famer. But if he stopped playing baseball right now, he has Hall of Fame numbers for me. If I were still voting for the Hall of Fame, I would vote for him, because this is the best start to a career that we have ever seen. And I don't think people appreciate that or understand that, because what he does, he's so consistent that the spectacular is almost just normal for him. He plays an elite center field. He hits with power similar to Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton and Bryce Harper and all of the other beasts in baseball. He runs as well as anybody in the game. There is not a flaw in Mike Trout's game. You look, he's walked 50 times, struck out only 46. I mean, you find very few guys who walk more than they strike out. This is one of the most special baseball players ever, entering his prime right now at 26 years old. And that's coming off of five seasons in which he could have arguably won the MVP. What we're looking at right now is one of the best players ever at perhaps his height. And so with Shohei Ohtani on the Angels, I almost think we lack an appreciation for what Trout not just has done, but what he's doing right now. It's incredible to see. And as somebody who loves baseball and who appreciates greatness, I think the combination of those two things for any baseball fan of Mike Trout right now is absolutely undeniable, and you're doing yourself a disservice if you're not watching the guy and appreciating.
Yeah, listen, I'm glad you laid it out like that, but let me ask you this. In terms of his career, in terms of his legacy that he might leave behind, how important is it, though, that the Angels reach the postseason on a consistent basis and then make noise once they get there?
You know, Mike Trout's one playoff series so far ended in a sweep at the hands of Kansas City after a 99-win season. So the idea that Mike Trout needs to get a great October to be recognized, I mean, I suppose we can look at Ernie Banks and say, you know, he was one of the all-time great players, but, you know, never had an October to speak of. I think that it would solidify Mike Trout's legacy and fulfill what he plays the game for. You know, he's not one of those guys who does this for himself. He wants to win, and he wants to win a ring. And it's why, you know, him being part of the pitch to Shohei Ohtani was as vital as it was. Like, Mike Trout was getting married, and he FaceTimed with Shohei Ohtani. And he said, hey, we need you here because we're capable of doing something special. And so to have him and to have Andrelton Simmons and to have Ohtani, those three, along with Justin Upton, really are the centerpieces of this team. And it's a team that can make some noise. But look, the Seattle Mariners are playing well. And the other playoff spots are set. We know the Indians are going. We know the Astros are going. We know the Yankees are going. We know that the Red Sox are going. It looks like it's going to be the Angels in a fight for the wild card, playing either the Yankees or the Red Sox. And having Mike Trout in a one-game playoff would be great for baseball and potentially great for that legacy you were talking about.
Jeff Passan, my guest. Listen, one last thought, if you don't mind. Off the board, I've got to ask you about, when it comes to baseball's popularity, what kind of an impact do you think the Supreme Court ruling, Jeff, on sports gambling might have on the game?
I mean, I think it could be potentially huge. Baseball is the sport that has a greater chance of creating degenerate gamblers than anything else. And I'm not saying that in a positive manner, but if you look at baseball, it's a very binary sport. And gambling can, especially gambling where it's going, Jim, is going to be a very binary thing. Smartphones are the best thing that ever happened for gambling, because you know that somebody is going to create a platform that you can almost turn into like penny slots or nickel
you
slots.
Bet. You
and
bet.
You're going to be able to say, is this going to be a ball or a strike? And you're going to be given odds. You know, it's going to pay off 10 cents for a ball and 5 cents for a strike, for example, because most pitchers are throwing about 2-to-1 strike to ball ratio. And you're going to have that. You're going to have what's the outcome of this at bat. It has the ability to make the seventh inning of an 8-to-1 game between two garbage teams in August mean something. And that's what baseball really needs, because baseball right now has turned into such a parochial sport that this has the ability to bring more people into the fold and learn and understand that there are teams outside of your zip code.
My man, despite what you said earlier in the conversation, you can go ahead and be arrogant enough to think that you are the best at what you do. Because Jeff Passan, I think you are. My man, Jeff Passan, breaking down all things relating to not only baseball, but even burner accounts on Twitter with an NBA executive, allegedly. Jeff, great to have you back, my man. Thank you very much.
Pleasure's always mine, my friend. Looking forward to the smack off, and see you next month.
Jeff in Montana. My man, Jeff, good morning. What's up?
Rome, what's going on?
Dude, where are you? Where are you in Montana?
I am in Butte, Montana.
Okay, good, good. Nice to have you. What's up?
Thanks, man. Hey, I want to reset the smack-off field a little bit. Talk about a couple guys, Vic and NoCal. Vic, you're like Robert De Niro. You used to be cool and edgy. Used to do cool stuff. Now you just do movies with 20-something-year-old girls, and it's not edgy, and it's not cool. You know what we want from you? We want to hear you say, hoorah, and say stuff that you used to say that was cool, because nothing you have to say anymore is fresh. Silk Bra is one of my favorites. Love that guy. He seems like the kind of guy you want to drink rosé with and hang out with, which is kind of one of the problems, Rome. It's the smack-off. You got to have some venom. You got to have some bite. Silk Bra doesn't have any bite anymore. He's a great guy. He's like Joe Johnson in the NBA. Everybody has something good to say about Joe Johnson. He's a great teammate. You're not going to win anything with him. He's a great guy. You got Mike in Indy. Mike spitting nothing but venom. Mike's the guy that comes in and brings it all the time.
Hey, Jeff, you're breaking up. My man, you're breaking up. I'm losing you. No, you're not. That's just my polite way of getting rid of you. Hey, Joe Johnson, how'd that taste? Have some of that, Joe Johnson. He comes in, he cracks Robert De Niro for not being edgy. All he does now is make movies with 20-year-old girls. Yeah, I mean, in his defense, dude, he's like 90 now. He's not going to make real edgy Ronin-type movies at age 90. In fact, my man's done a great job of reinventing, evolving. I mean, better than Pacino, by the way. And I think that's what you're reaching for with your hoorah, right?
Hoorah.
Pacino, not De Niro.
Hoorah!
And Silk, man. Silk's a guy you want to drink rosé with? I don't think Silk's a big rosé guy, brah. Hey, listen, brah. He won the smack-off. I think your point is, yeah, he won the smack-off back in the day when he had some edge. He never had that kind of edge. He's got some good off-speed stuff, Silk. He changes speeds. He'll change you up. He's good. He hits the spots. He's got good command. He's got good location. He's never going to be that guy that's going to run it right by you. My man's crafty.
Bruh.
He's crafty. He changes speeds. He hits his spots.
Bruh.
He's fearless up there.
Bruh.
Hoorah.
Bruh.
Hoorah.
Bruh.
All right.
Hoorah.
Really, really quickly. Silk heard that. Silk wanted in. He wants to respond. I love it when a caller comes in, cracks another caller, and then the first guy is listening and wants to respond quickly. I'm all about that life. Let's go to Huntington Beach. Silk, brah, what's up? Good morning.
Hey, Jimmy. How you doing, buddy? Hey, just was out on the catching the Big Ten out there on the side of the 11s, you know what I mean? And I'm RSVPing for the smack off. Come on.
No. That was not Silk.
You don't like that.
That was the fake Silk.
Come on.
Not a very good call.
That was the fake Silk doing Silk. Now all we need is the fake Silk, the fake Silk doing the fake Silk.
Come on.
I always let the fake Silk, first of all, I know the second he utters his first word that it's the fake Silk. I always let him go until he gets his first, come on.
Come on.
Because it's so bad. All right, don't rack the fake Silk. Man, I got my hopes up. Fourth pick overall in 1985 out of Pittsburgh. He is a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, class of 2012. Hometown Hall of Famer ceremony presented by Ford Motor Company is going to honor Chris Dolman's alma mater, and it's going to take place tomorrow. He joins me right now. Chris, it is so nice to have you on the program. How are you?
Jim, I'm doing good. I'm sorry for the background noise. I'm here at Atlanta Airport in the Delta Lounge.
My man, no worries at all, Chris. You know, you and I, we had a plan that we were going to get together and talk at the Super Bowl, and then you had a health situation that you had to deal with, and I want to ask you about that shortly, but I'm very happy to be talking to you right now. You know, let's talk about kind of your life for a moment. Go back a little bit to your days in York, Pennsylvania. What was life like growing up in York?
Small town, just good people, you know. It was almost like small town America. I mean, everybody came out for the Friday night football game. Everybody knew you in town. You know, football, high school sports, big. Football, basketball. So, I mean, I enjoyed that growing up there.
Well, you were an All-State. You were an All-State tight end, defensive end, and a legendary punter. And you played ball at William Penn High School. But not only were you doing that on the football field, you also averaged 13 points, 15 rebounds, and 7 blocks a game as a basketball player. You led the team to its first district title in years. I mean, it's pretty clear you could play some basketball. So what was it about football that really hooked you and became your thing?
You know, the thing about football was that there was a lot of guys my size playing basketball, you know. So to be able to go and, you know, be a big guy on the football field and made a big difference. That's why I chose football over basketball.
It's the right choice, Chris. You made it to the Hall of Fame. But one more thought about basketball. Well, and by the way, you played volleyball as well. But going back to basketball for a moment, there was a legendary matchup where you went up against Sam Bowie and Lebanon High School. You held him to a career-low 11 points. What do you remember about that game?
I remember I beat him up. He's a big dude. 7'1", he's the biggest guy I've ever played against. Sam's a great guy. I haven't seen him in years. But he was a quality kid then. He went on to Kentucky. We had some health issues, but we got to Portland. But, you know, I've always been a big fan of him. Yes.
Chris Dolman joining me. You know, Chris, you were the fourth pick overall in 1985, and you came into the NFL. I'm curious, what were your expectations for your career? Did you always know that you had Hall of Fame potential?
Not at all. Jim, my whole thing was to be able to play major college football. That's all I wanted to do. I look forward to the time that I could run out of, I was looking forward to the time that I could run out of the tunnel where your family can watch you play.
And I was so afraid the dogs were going to do that. Chris, you and John Randall and Henry Thomas caused some serious havoc together on the field. Man, I got to tell you, Chris, I used to talk to John Randall on the show. I used to get such a kick out of him, watching him play and then talking to him. What about those guys? What were they like to you as teammates and friends? And what was it like to go to battle with those guys?
Totally different than players of today. We really cared about each other. You know, we were a straight up team. People don't know this. We had a bowling team that all of us, every Thursday night, Henry Thomas, Johnny Randall, Keith Millard, we had a local bowling team when we would get out there. People look at us, isn't that the Vikings defensive line? Yep, we're out here bowling just like everybody else. You know, it was funny, our name was the Alligators. But we truly cared about each other. Every Saturday, we would have breakfast together.
You know, Chris, I mentioned that you and I were going to get together the week of Super Bowl and have this conversation. But the story goes, earlier this year, you started to feel like things were not quite right, and you went to see your doctor, and then ultimately word came back that you had brain cancer. What was your reaction when you heard that news?
Scared to death. You know, when you get that diagnosis, that's usually mean you always feel that's a death sentence. I tell you what happened was I had a little droopy lip. My nose was running. The day before, I was playing golf. I was good playing golf.
Chris,
next thing I know, I go into the doctor, and he says, you have three masses on the right side of your brain. Ever since then, my life has changed. you know, it's been hard, but, you know, I just keep, you know, with prayer, staying with it.
Chris,
it can always be worse.
Chris Dolman is my guest. Chris, brain cancer are maybe the two scariest words you can possibly hear, and I know this to be true because, Chris, my father was diagnosed with leukemia, and he had brain cancer. And I remember what it was like when they wheeled him in for brain surgery, and I remember what it was like when he came out. It's terrifying. So my question is, how were you able to remain as calm as possible and start working on your plan and dealing with that challenge in front of you?
I wasn't calm. I was crying. I ain't afraid to say it. When someone tells you something like that, you know, you got a fixed amount of time left. No matter what you do, this thing is growing in your body. This is what it's going to do. You don't do nothing, you lose. You go in there and try to fix it, and you could lose while you're getting trying to fix it. It's just part of the deal. It's a humbling experience.
So when you're in the hospital, a lot of your guys came through. A lot of the Vikings, a lot of the football community, guys like Greg Coleman, Steve Jordan, Henry Thomas, Ken Clark. What was that like? How much did that mean to you?
I've had a lot of support, a lot of Viking support. The Wolf family has been amazing. Jim, I don't know who today can afford health care. There's one product that I use. It's called Optune. That's $21,000 a month. That's a lot of coin a month.
My friend, that is a lot of coin. It's a hell of a lot of coin. $21,000 a month. And you're right. Who can afford something like that? You know, you've talked about also, though, Chris, that it's a blessing to wake up every single morning. That, yeah, I mean, it would be so hard to go through something like that and not view your life differently. Can you share how much it's changed the way you look at life and now your approach to things?
Absolutely. You know, every time you go to sleep, it might be the last time. You know, I'm still dealing with the residual issues where I'm paralyzed on my left side. I'm constantly dropping things, walking into the wall, walking into tables and chairs. If it's on my left side, my vision is good. I don't know what it is. My balance is just, I end up finding a way to hit it.
You've got a big weekend, however. You're going to be honored tomorrow as part of the Hometown Hall of Famer ceremony presented by Ford Motor Company. Chris, knowing everything that you've been through this year, what does this ceremony mean to you?
I'm looking forward to it, too. I want the kids to realize, once they place that plaque there, I want the kids to realize they can do anything they want to do or become anything they want to become. We grew up in a small community, maybe 60,000-70,000 people. You know, I got family that still live in that community. So you can get out the same way I got out. There are so many ways that you can make a change in your life. You just got to figure out how you want to change your life. You know, I'll be living proof for you. And that's the cool thing.
Seems to me, too. You know what's cool? You get to go back home. What's it going to be like to go back home and see where it all started, to be with people you know, people you love, people who love you? What's it like to go back home, especially given everything you've been through?
I think it's going to be really cool. I'll get a chance to see my dad, and, you know, one of my best friends, the kid that I grew up with. We played Little League against each other. To be able to sit there and see him tonight and catch up with everybody, old high school teammates. I'm talking pony football, Little League. be able to reminisce in those days.
You know, Chris,
talk about our families today, how they're doing. You know, you can probably imagine. I'm godparents to a lot of those, my buddy's kids. It gives me a chance to see them, which is great.
It is great. You remember the Pro Football Hall of Fame class of 2012, an eight-time Pro Bowler. The Hometown Hall of Famer ceremony is presented by the Ford Motor Company, and it is going to honor Chris Dolman's alma mater. It's going to take place tomorrow. He's going back home. Chris, I'm really glad that we could have this conversation. You, my friend, are a warrior and an inspiration, and our thoughts are with you. I know you're going to keep grinding through this thing, and I would love to talk to you again soon. It's really nice to hear your voice, Chris. I'm really glad we could talk. I hope you have an amazing weekend.
Thank you. I'm available for you anytime you want to do it.
My man.
Good night!